This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Coming up, a bit of John Entwistle's bass. But first, the U.S. Supreme Court handed down two decisions that will change how capital punishment is administered in this country. The court decided that mentally retarded persons cannot be executed. And in a separate case, they held that only juries can decide to sentence convicted murderers to die. These decisions come at a time in which public attitudes in America toward capital punishment may be shifting slightly. 10 years ago, only 18% of the American public opposed the death penalty. Today, that figure has risen to 25%, as overall confidence in guilty verdicts has waned somewhat. Illinois and Maryland, for instance, have declared moratoriums on executions after a number of death row prisoners had their convictions overturned. The Supreme Court once abolished capital punishment in the United States, briefly, between 1972 and 1976. Is this court making decisions that may discourage prosecutors from seeking the death penalty and therefore substantially reduce the number of convicted murderers who are executed? We are joined by Joshua Marquis, a district attorney in Astoria, Oregon, and member of the board of directors of the National District Attorneys Association. Mr. Marquis, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And Elizabeth Semmel. She's director of the Death Penalty Clinic at the University of California, Berkeley School of Law, and former director of the American Bar Association Death Penalty Representation Project. Ms. Semmel, thank you for being with us.
Thank you as well for inviting me.
And if we could begin, Mr. Marquis, you first, then Ms. Semmel. Do either of you see any kind of link or trend in these decisions this week?
Yes. Death penalty opponents often say that the American people, you know, are having a change of heart about the death penalty. Polls, not just the Gallup poll, but other ones, seem to reflect otherwise. At the same time, we have decisions like the Supreme Court decisions that have come down, and a number of moves in Congress by some senators and congresspeople that seem to sort of be nibbling around the edge of the death penalty. The best analogy I can think of politically is probably the same thing that's been happening with the abortion debate in the United States, a subject about which people feel passionately. And that is, the opponents of abortion, I think, have recognized that the American people are not going to abolish abortion. So instead, the political tactic has been to try to sort of nibble around the edges. That's sort of what's happening with cases like the Atkins decision and the other decision. It's not probably going to profoundly affect the way the death penalty is carried out, but I think what you said is probably correct. I think it probably is intended to discourage prosecutors from seeking the death penalty.
Mm-hmm. Well, before this turns into a monologue, I think I need to disagree on several significant points. People doing polls are beginning to ask, do you support capital punishment or the alternative of life without possibility of parole? And when that question is asked, in many jurisdictions and nationally, support for the death penalty drops below 50%. And I wouldn't go so far as to say that we've turned into a nation of abolitionists. But what we have turned into, and I think this is reflected in the court's decision, is a nation that is reconsidering whether or not we ought to continue to impose the death penalty.
Well, Mr. Marquis, this might fall in your lap quicker than anybody else as a prosecutor. Are you going to be deterred from seeking certain prosecutions or asking for certain punishment in certain cases?
Well, as a prosecutor who has sought the death penalty, but like most prosecutors, more often does not seek the death penalty when it's eligible, this is an extraordinarily carefully thought out decision. In my state, in Oregon, there's only 27 people on death row, and I think Oregon juries rarely impose the death penalty and Oregon prosecutors rarely seek it. That is much more the standard around the United States than the few states that have a lot of people on death row. In most states, as in my state, people who are charged with capital crimes are represented by good lawyers who are extremely well-funded. But that's not the conventional wisdom.
That is an outrageously irresponsible statement. You know, Oregon is so exceptional in that regard. If you look at the states that impose and carry out capital punishment most frequently, and those are the southern states, you are talking about states like Alabama, for example, which has no public defender system, Georgia, which has a few public defender offices. Most of the states that have capital punishment, I mean, the scandal across this country has been poor quality counsel. Houston, Harris County, Texas, which has sent more people to death row than any other state in the United States, save the state of Texas, has no public defender system. So the norm, I'm afraid to tell you, in having spent 4 years traveling around the country trying to recruit lawyers to take these cases on a pro bono, that is, volunteer basis, is the poor quality of representation of the capital punishment system in this country.
Well, let me ask a question. Could these two decisions confirm what some suggested is a trend, which is that the Supreme Court is, in a sense, making capital punishment ultimately legally unassailable by sweeping out all the questions about adequate counsel and taking people with mental disability away from being considered for capital punishment? So at the end, you wind up ratifying and upholding the general principle that it is a right and decent punishment to execute people who are convicted of first-degree murder.
Well, if I can weigh in there, I guess I would ask Elizabeth, who I know has waged a long war against capital punishment, whether there's any reforms that would ever satisfy her and other people who believe, as she does, that the death penalty can ever be administered fairly.
No. The fact of the matter is that the kinds of failings of the capital punishment system, beginning with race discrimination, beginning with the poverty of lawyering, continuing through the arbitrariness of its imposition on a geographic basis, I don't think that we have the ability to rectify those wrongs. And I would add to that, obviously, the number of people who are wrongfully convicted and sentenced to death, some of whom, in fact, are executed.
Let me ask about the second decision, if I could, which required juries to approve of the death penalty when they're handed down in capital cases. Mr. Marquis, speaking as a prosecutor and someone, I gather, who has also been a defense attorney for indigent clients, does this open up the possibility of jury nullification in capital cases? Do you, as a prosecutor, say, well, maybe we'll get eight people on the jury, but if there might be one or two people we'll never get, therefore we're not going to ask the death penalty?
Well, two things. Yes, but there has always been the possibility, and maybe jury nullification, although it's, I think, generally a bad concept, and the death penalty is not such a terrible idea. In Oregon, and I believe in most places, all 12 jurors in the penalty phase have to agree that death is the appropriate sentence. So I don't think it's unusual. In fact, in most cases, when juries have a choice between life without the possibility of parole and death, they're going to choose something other than a death sentence, and that's probably not inappropriate.
I want to thank you both very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Joshua Marquis is a district attorney in Astoria, Oregon, and member of the board of directors of the National District Attorneys Association, and Elizabeth Semmel, director of the Death Penalty Clinic at the University of California, Berkeley School of Law.